Hi, I'm Steve Dace. So if you're looking for a summer worldview camp, this is the place to be. July 16th through the 20th, we're going to encourage your kids to become the next generation of cultural leaders. We've got pastors like Douglas Wilson, filmmakers, cultural critics and commentators like myself and Matt Walsh from The Daily Wire. Sign up at calledconference.ninja. Again, Moscow, Idaho, July 16th through the 20th, calledconference.ninja.
Hello, welcome back to the New St. Andrews College podcast. My name is Ben Merkel. I'm president of New St. Andrews, and I am back again with Dr. Jason Greaser, NSA's Fellow of Literature. Today, Jason, we're going to dive in to focus on Hamlet. I know you've been teaching Shakespeare for a while, and then we're looking at the sort of subsection of tragedy, but specifically want to look at Hamlet today. So I asked this question last time, but Jason, how many times have you worked through Hamlet with the students at NSA?
This one from the first, this one even further back than Macbeth, so probably 10 years.
Okay, so 10 years of going through Hamlet once a year. So I suppose there are a few things about the play that have gotten interesting to you. Let's just start with general worldview of the play. Like, what's the overarching worldview that Shakespeare is communicating with this one?
Yeah, it's been described as an atmosphere of claustrophobia. So it's suffused with questions, over 400 questions in this play. And the famous, you know, to be or not to be, that is right. The question. It opens up with who's there, a question. And it's the interesting thing, too, is that not all the questions can be answered. And so you get questions that you have to try to find an answer. So you have to do the interpretive work. And one of the reasons why the play is so famous is because it is so open and subtle. It's so round. You know, you can't fit it in a box. You can't figure out certain things. And you have to do your best interpretive work to try to make sense of certain parts of the play. For instance, you know, is Hamlet literally mad at some point in the play? It's not entirely clear if he actually crosses over into madness. He puts on an antic disposition. Does he actually go mad at some point in the play? Is something to debate? What does Gertrude know about the, you know, she's married Claudius, her husband's brother. Does she know that he killed the king, old Hamlet? That's not entirely clear. Does Hamlet love Ophelia for real? You know, that's not entirely clear. And why does Hamlet wait to take action against the against his uncle? And, you know, he's told by the ghost that exactly what happened, should he trust that ghost? So there's these huge questions that sort of haunt you as they haunt him. And you have to work hard to interpret the play. And I think that's why it's one of the favorites of Western civilization.
You said right there at the beginning, you summarized the worldview as this sensation of claustrophobia, which I think is just really interesting. I mean, from a completely different perspective, but it's one of the things that's the language of claustrophobia is actually used in the Psalms quite a bit to describe. You don't catch it a lot of times in the English translations, but in the Hebrew, it's specifically referring to the sensation of being in a tight place, and deliverance comes when God makes things wide open for you. And so that idea of claustrophobia, that's always sort of struck in my head of it. Like, that's what it looks like when you're going through trials and whatnot. And I'm curious what's claustrophobic about Hamlet?
Everywhere you go and every conversation seems to be unclear as to whether or not you can trust the person you're talking to. So it's within this this kingdom that's been poisoned by you know, the killing of the king, and now no one trusts anyone, no one trusts each other, and so you have people spying on you everywhere you go, and there's really no free place. So if you watch the modern version that I've seen it, I sometimes assign is the David Tennant version of Hamlet, where there's security cameras everywhere in every set. There's security cameras watching you.
Wow. Okay.
You know, and there's everyone seems to be acting in the sense of you know, there's that pun there that they're actors on a stage, but everyone's also acting a certain part. Then you can't really trust anybody.
Okay.
So that's the claustrophobia.
Yeah.
That you feel.
I could see how that'd be very oppressive.
Yes.
So let's get into some of the play's specific questions then. What are we to make of the ghost?
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's one of those questions that you never fully... there's not evidence in the play to fully answer the question. You have to interpret it as best you can.
Set the scene up just a little bit for folks that maybe haven't read the play.
I think if we look at it from Hamlet's perspective, right? He is, we see him at the beginning of the play where his uncle's become king, married his mother. He's in black. He's very upset about this. Something is not right. He knows something is not right. Doesn't know what it is. Then when he meets the ghost and the ghost says, "I'm your father from purgatory. I'm going to tell you exactly what happened. I wasn't stung by a serpent in a literal sense of, you know, I was asleep in the garden and a snake bit me. That's what the report is out there. But actually, the serpent that killed me was your uncle who poured poison in my ear, you know, and took the throne from me and took my wife." And Hamlet is like, he says, "Oh, my prophetic soul, my uncle." Like he sensed that something had, his uncle was somehow involved in this, complicitous in this. So at that point, he's convinced that he needs to go immediately and kill Claudius and purge the kingdom of this evil, this serpent king. But then there's a delay for a time, and he starts to ponder it a little more, and he's not so sure. And he ends up saying, "Maybe it's, you know, in my melancholy that the devil is trying to deceive me, and I can't trust this ghost."
So how long does that delay then happen? And what's the
There's
the
a couple
point
of
that?
Months of delay where he's just. He says I'm gonna put on an antic disposition to sort of to hide from his uncle and to sort of stall to get some time to sort of work through this. And he decides that, you know, maybe the answer, he decides on putting on a play. So we have a play within a play. He's gonna put on a play when he hears that the players are coming. He puts on a play and he inserts some of his own lines. And so they reenact on the stage what the ghost had told him, and you see the in the play within the play up on the stage, they're pouring poison in the ear of the king, and that's when his uncle stands up and says, you know, lights, no more, stop the play. And so Hamlet sees that and he says, there's some evidence of his guilt. And then he says to Horatio, his friend who he trusts very much, says, "Horatio, did you see what happened? Did you see the way he responded?" And Horatio says, "Yes, I did. And then Hamlet says, "I'll take the ghost's word for £1,000. And Horatio says, "Yeah, I would too." So at that point, they've got something to go on. It still, is that fully convincing? You see him get up and say, lights, at the, you know, watching that happen. It's not like he has legal proof that he could go public with that. "I saw him flinch, therefore I can kill the king." You know, it's still a question, but he's got something to go on.
So now last week when we were talking about Macbeth, you laid out for us the various elements of a tragedy. And I believe in that one of the steps was when the tragic hero passes a point of no return. There's this moment where they pass a point of no return. Is this where Hamlet has passed it, or is that still to come?
It's right after that. So here he seems convinced. He's got the proof. He's done this play test, and he's seen the king's response. He's seen the guilt. Then in the next scene, King Claudius is alone in prayer, and Hamlet pulls out his sword and he says, "Now I can do it." Just the two of them, he can just cut his head off right there, and it's done. And he pulls out his sword and he walks up behind him. He's about to kill him, and then he says, "But wait a minute. If I kill him when he's in prayer, he'll go straight to heaven. So how would that be revenge? My father's in purgatory. He was killed in his sin without confessing his sin, and I'm going to send my uncle straight to heaven while he's here in prayer?" So he puts his sword back in his sheath, and he decides not to do it. And one critic I like on this is Sister Miriam Joseph, and she says, at that moment, Hamlet had crossed from justice to hatred, and he's going to become like a god and try to damn him to hell, which isn't his role at all. All he's supposed to do is pursue justice, purge the kingdom. Instead, he decides he needs to damn him to hell, and he's going to wait until he can do that. So he moves into hatred there, and that's when things. So I think that's the moment of no return. He had his moment, he didn't do it, and now he's from there. In the next scene, he kills Polonius, an innocent person. And then Polonius' son Laertes now comes back from France to try to avenge his father on Hamlet. So Hamlet now has a guy chasing him and wanting to kill him, and everything sort of unravels from there into the final tragic moment when he dies, Laertes dies, the king dies, Gertrude dies.
So why does
stage is covered with dead people?
why does he finally act against Claudius? What is it that finally moves him to act?
This is interesting. There's a debate about whether or not Hamlet changes later in the play. I think he does. He comes back from, his uncle had said, he's just mad, he's dangerous, send him to England. They ship him away. While he's being shipped off, he uncovers a letter that says basically that Claudius is sending him to his death in England. A letter to the King of England says, you know, my nephew arrives, execute him. Mm-hmm. So he uncovers that. There's more proof for against the king. And then there's the scenes where he's in the grave in Act 5. One of the greatest scenes in literature is the gravedigger scene. Right. You've probably seen the Kenneth Branagh version, which is just fantastic. And he's there meditating on death. Right? He's holding skulls up and looking at him and thinking, is this what Caesar has become? Is this Alexander the Great? Yorick, the guy that was my father's jester, is this, you know, he's got his skull in his hand and he's just meditating on mortality and his own death. And he's that pride we saw where he thought he could damn his uncle to hell, you know, that kind of godlike pride, it sort of evaporates here and he's humbled and he recognizes the truth of his own mortality and death. Also, Ophelia has died and he's complicit in that. And I think he's literally in the grave wrestling with Laertes. I think that's where he comes out of that. So there, I think he's sort of understood his own mortality. He's been humbled. And then after that, he starts talking about God's providence. So I think the play goes from a kind of pagan fate to an embracing of providence. And he, really beautiful passage where he talks about there's special providence in the fall of a sparrow, he says, one of the most famous lines. And he doesn't just say providence, it's special providence, which would mean his whole life, you know, the Calvinistic sense where your whole life is ordained by God. And he says, I'm going to go take action. I'm going to fence with Laertes. And he kind of senses this is going to be the end. It's going to be the end for him, or it could be anyway. But he knows that a special providence is running his life, is in charge of his life. And so I think he's gone from really an unsure sense of who is he, who am I, he has a sense of damnation throughout the play. There's heaven and hell pretty clearly in the Christian worldview of the play, but here he's become more confident and trusting in providence as he takes the action there at the end. So I think it's a combination of the coming face to face with death, as I talked about last time, and the absolutes in a tragedy, death. You just can't avoid it, and he recognizes that. And then he comes to trust in providence. So I think there's something like it's a dark play for sure, and the kingdom of the play is dark, it's poisoned, but there's a little bit of a brightening here towards the end where he talks about a special providence.
So what do you hope for your readers to walk away from working through Hamlet with? Why should the play matter to us today? What sorts of things should you be walking out having seen, learned?
It's what's really, this play has sometimes, I think you can make the case pretty easily, it's the greatest play ever written. And you know, one of the questions is why. There's something about it that just resists interpretation. It's just, you can't ever fully feel like you've got it.
Why is that a good thing?
Because it's asking the really big questions that aren't simple, right? And it does it in a way that mirrors life and sort of focuses your mind on those big questions like death. Or
it's good to not have the door quite swing all the way shut so that you keep working at it.
Yes. And it doesn't take a simple view of those things. We ourselves have to face various, you know, Hamlet has to face his uncle who's the poisoner of the kingdom. And he has to take action when he doesn't always know exactly what's right. And that mirrors our own lives, right? So I think we see ourselves in him. And he has to, in the end, he has to sort of act in faith. And some critics think he's totally wrong. I mean, there's different readings of this play. I think he should not have ever taken the sword to King Claudius in the end. But in the end, when he sees that the poisoning is really coming from the king, and there's the poisoning I talked about earlier where the lies, okay, that's a kind of poisoning. But then there's literally poison on the foils. And Laertes says, the king told me to do this. So I'm, you know, Hamlet gets hit by the poisoned tip. Mm-hmm. Laertes gets hit by the poisoned tip. They're both going to die. And then the king had poisoned the cup, and he wanted Hamlet to drink it. And instead, Gertrude drinks it accidentally.
His wife.
Or maybe on purpose. It's right. Not clear if she's okay. Killing herself or if she doesn't quite know and drinks the cup. And so then he kills. Then he kills them, right? So was that the just thing to do? You know, in one sense, yes. Other critics say, no, he should never have done that. He should have tried to work towards his uncle's repentance or something. You get a more, nonviolent take on it. And so you really have to, it clarifies your own thoughts on these things, and you really have to wrestle with, as Hamlet did, like, what is my, how do I take action? It's all about taking action. How do I know the truth? How do I avoid being deceived? So Hamlet talks about holding a mirror up to nature as what acting does or what a play does. It holds a mirror up to nature. I think this play holds a mirror up to us. It holds a mirror up to our world and shows us that we are in a similar situation. And so he really resonates with us in our own condition.
Do you have a favorite production of Hamlet?
There's ones I like for different reasons. So the Kenneth Branagh has a nasty sex scene in it. Other than that, it's very good. The thing he does with it is interesting is he takes, there's three different texts of the play. So he just combines them all and makes it, you know, any line from the quarto or the folio, first, second quarto or the folio, he just combines them all, makes a composite text. It's 4 hours long. So it's super long. It probably wouldn't, it looks like from what scholars can tell, the plays are about 2.5 hours. So it would have been cut. Yeah. He gives you the full. So that's, there's a vote for that. But then there's the newer one that I like is the David Tennant Hamlet, which is more goofy. But I think he captures a side of Hamlet that's really good. And that one's 3 hours.
And goofy in what sense?
Well, it's David Tennant. So the madness comes across more as just comic goofiness rather than serious madness, which is I think is a legitimate way of reading it, and I like that one a lot. Those two would be ones I would recommend. In general I like the new DVDs or the Globe Theater in London is filming their plays and putting them out on DVD. I try to get those whenever possible, but there isn't a Hamlet available yet, but I'm looking forward to seeing one of those so you can see it on stage. Because these two I'm talking about are both film. They've turned it into a film rather than although the David Tennant one is pretty sparse. It's almost like an onstage production, but not quite.
Let's say somebody hasn't read Shakespeare before. How would you recommend that they get started?
I like the Folger Shakespeare Library.
Uh-huh.
They have all the plays. They also have very helpful notes and little summaries before each section. So Shakespeare can be difficult. For modern readers, this will gloss difficult words for you, and it'll also give you little summaries here and there. And it has little woodcuts and things from the period that they'll include throughout to kind of explain things. So these are my favorite editions of the play.
Should somebody read the play first or watch it first?
I like to read it first and then watch it. But I think that's probably, if someone is really struggling to read it, they should probably watch it. If you can read it and even I recommend that the first read would be a pretty quick read. Don't try to figure everything out. You'll never get through it.
Mm-hmm.
So read it fairly quickly and then come back and read it more meticulously. And then I think the reward is then you get to watch it. But not everyone, you know, works that way. Some people really need to watch it first to get a sense of how the play works and then work on the text. I think either could work. When I teach it here, I want them to read it first, grapple with it a bit, and then we watch it as kind of the payoff.
Okay. And what's your favorite, personal favorite of Shakespeare's plays?
I like these tragedies, and I really couldn't, whether it's Macbeth, Hamlet, Lear, or Othello.
Okay. You just like the tragedies.
Yeah,
okay.
I do. These are my favorites. And I'm currently teaching Much Ado About Nothing in the English course, so it's a brilliant comedy.
Yeah.
So the thing that really blows people's minds is that Shakespeare could write the best comedies and tragedies. How does one guy do both of those? You know, so I like his comedies as well. But yeah, I am a particularly fan of these great tragedies.
Well, thanks very much, and we will see you again next week.